Small businesses in Massachusetts employ more than 1.5 million people here. And some of those employers are now going to have to require their employees to be vaccinated or to test negative for COVID once a week. Here is President Joe Biden announcing a major set of new COVID-19 vaccination mandates at the end of last week.
I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week.
So keep in mind, Governor Baker has also mandated that more than 40,000 public sector employees in the Commonwealth will have to be vaccinated and with no testing option. Now, in the face of more mandates, some are turning to religious exemptions, citing faith as a way to skip the shots. We often ask on this show, can they do that? Can the president mandate shots this way? The governor, can people avoid them on religious grounds? How easy is that? And how well is Massachusetts protected from these legal battles? Because they're coming, we know it, and other iconic legal battles of the moment. Well, we get to ask Nancy Gertner. Isn't that great? Retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. I love getting to ask you this stuff, Judge Gertner. Welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be on.
All right, so we're going to do this can they do that thing, and I do want to start with the mandates. Just to be clear, President Biden clearly believes that the Labor Department can impose a vaccine mandate requirement on employers at least of a certain size. Can they? How solid is the legal footing for that? And does the size of the company matter in whether he's allowed to do it or not?
Well, I'll answer your 15 questions all at once here. And so the answer is yes, he can do it. And there are two strains of authority here. One is a rather broad range of authorities for the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, which really dates to the 30s, I believe, in which the OSHA is empowered to regulate safety issues in the workplace. Who wears hard hats? What kind of masks do you need, et cetera? And so vaccinations squarely fit within that authority. And even the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, which deals with other workplace rules, said that it's okay to mandate vaccinations as long as you provide accommodations for people who either can't get them or they're immunocompromised or something like that. I'll deal with the religious issue in a minute. And then we have a very lengthy tradition, which I want to call vaccinations are different. From the 20s, when there was a smallpox outbreak in Massachusetts, actually, courts have mandated vaccinations for public school, mandated, you know, measles and rubella, all the things that our kids hated to get, but were in fact required before they could go to public school. You can't mandate other things. But vaccinations were always seen as a way of, as critical, not just for your health, but for my health as well. So there's a tradition of workplace safety rules and really an independent tradition that whatever exceptions there are in other areas, vaccinations that are efficacious, vaccinations that are disease preventive, certainly can be mandated. The size question is a little bit of a contrivance. I mean, he could have picked 50 employees. He could have picked 25. He's, in fact, made this apply only to the larger employers, but that wasn't necessary at all. He could have made it to smaller employers as well.
So that was actually a political choice, not a legal choice, basically.
That's right. That was a political choice, yes.
All right, so I'm struck by something you said. You began with OSHA, right, which is a federal agency. Then, and at the beginning, I talked about the fact that President Biden has some mandates in place. Governor Baker has mandated for 40,000 public employees. You mentioned a Massachusetts case, which Jamie Bologna, one of our producers, tells me he thinks is the Jacobson versus Massachusetts
case. Right, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, right.
Excellent. So that makes me wonder, how much of this is federal power, how much is state power, and does Governor Baker have the same rights as President Biden, or do states have different rights? Could this play out differently in Massachusetts than elsewhere?
The federal authorities clearly have the OSHA authority. You know that has been basically in place for years. State authorities have police power and have power over public safety issues and public health issues. That's why before there was a vaccine, President Trump was talking about his limited authority over state authorities to get them to do X or Y. So, yes, there's independent state authorities. In fact, many states have their own occupational health and safety regimes. So, yes, Governor Baker has his own authority under a public health rubric to do this. Now, there's always, as I said, there'll be people who come forward with physical disabilities that make it impossible for them to get vaccines. In addition, there may be people who would say vaccinations were unavailable. That justification is getting more and more narrow. And then there's the religious the exemption, supposedly, to vaccinations. But again, we've really plumbed this for some time, and the religious exception, so-called, is really very, very narrow.
Yeah, so let's go there. And again, I'm assuming when we talk about religious exception that there's both federal guidance on this and state guidance, and that they might not be the same. So how narrow is it? Is it more narrow here than elsewhere, or religious exemption and vaccines is well-settled law everywhere?
Well, it's not well settled anywhere, actually. There is a law that was called the RFRA, which was the Religious Freedom of Religion Act, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which applies to the federal government, which says that something that burdens a person's exercise of religion must be in furtherance, can be justified only if there's a compelling government interest and it's the least restrictive means. So let's start with that. That affects the federal government. That was the law that was implicated when the Affordable Care Act litigation went up, exempting certain Hobby Lobby, if you recall, from having to require a contraceptive mandate for their insurance coverage. So this is called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But again, that's a religious accommodation unless the government has a compelling interest and unless they're using the least restrictive means of effecting it. What's a compelling interest? There really could be no more compelling interest than public health here. And vaccinations, as they say, promote long history of vaccinations for smallpox, for polio, et cetera, promote public health. The state has its own rules. I believe the state has its own OSHA-like regulations for state employees, and the Religious Freedom Act doesn't apply to the state, but someone could come forward and say, taking this vaccination offends my right to practice my religion. Again, this is really a very different area than we've talked about before. The right to bake a cake for a homosexual couple, or the right to have contraceptives as part of your package of insurance, that's very different than rights which offend not just your health, but mine and everybody else's. So if there's a balance here, I think the balance goes very strongly in favor of the government mandating vaccinations.
So the government basically has a claim that trumps the interest of a private individual. I felt like I had to clarify that. The private individual's religious objections because of the specific public health nature, your ability to do harm to someone else by employing your religious objection.
Right. And, it's very interesting. People who are claiming a religious exemption here, you have to ask the question about whether these same people objected to smallpox, rubella, polio, all the vaccinations that kids needed before they went to public school. And if you didn't object to those, how could you possibly object to this?
Now, we do know that there are those, and I want to point out the major religions, including the Catholic Church, have essentially said, get the vaccine. But there are those who have argued that the use of a fetal cell line that originated, as I understand it from research we did preparing for today, there's a Reuters article on this, originated in 1985. But there was a use of that in testing of multiple vaccines, and that is the basis of some people's personal objections, despite the fact that the Christian traditions seem to be saying, no, get the vaccine.
Well, there's really no basis to conclude that the vaccine that you're getting, what's going into your arm, derive from fetal cells. So what the Reuters article suggests is that fetal cells, older fetal cells from, 20 years ago, may well have been used in the research to test the efficaciousness of the vaccine. But you're really talking about something that is extraordinarily, convoluted and really not related to anything that's going into your arm. And again, that may well have applied to all of the vaccines that we're talking about here that have been tested at some point in the past using fetal cells. So I think I can't imagine that a court would regard this as a real issue.
All right, so I'm going to move on to one other subject that I wanted to talk to you about, one other subject. And it's almost like a once more with feeling, because I've asked you this a couple of times in the past, including, for example, during confirmation hearings for now Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, which is, if federal law changes in terms of abortion protections, how would that impact the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? And you have mostly said we're fairly stable because of the strength of our local laws. Texas is a big deal, and people are watching it, so I'm asking again.
It would not affect Massachusetts at all. In 1980, actually, I was one of the lawyers. I and my husband represented a class of women challenging Medicaid restrictions on abortion funding. The court then situated the right to choose abortion, found that there was a right to choose abortion under the Massachusetts Constitution. And since it's under the Massachusetts Constitution, whatever the U.S. Supreme Court does will not affect us, will not affect us at all. There's really only one conceivable exception, and it's very unlikely, and that would be if the Supreme Court decided that fetuses were persons under the Constitution. That would affect everyone.
And you're saying you think it's unlikely the court is going to do that?
That's unlikely, yeah. I mean, I think that what the court will do is to say Roe v. Wade, well, either the court will regulate Roe v. Wade out of existence, which really was the path that they were already going down even before these new additions to the court. Whether they would say, as the Texas law says, essentially, Roe v. Wade is gone because it doesn't matter about fetal viability, there's no protection under the federal constitution. They may well do that. But I don't think that they would go so far as to say women have rights under the Constitution. Apparently, corporations have rights and fetuses have rights under the Constitution. That trump other, again, small t, that mm-hmm. trump the rights of others. I don't think they would go that far. I think that the likelihood, strong likelihood, is that the Massachusetts law will hold. Massachusetts, Hawaii, numbers of state constitutions have been interpreted this way, and the U.S. Supreme Court will not be able to undo our rights here.
Now, there's another aspect of the Texas law which seeks to use enforcement not via the government but via private citizens who have the right to sue other private citizens if they believe they are aiding or abetting an abortion after 6 weeks. That aiding and abetting, I have heard, is something that other states are watching. Is that precedent something that you would be concerned about in future law in Massachusetts on other issues?
Well, on other issues, who knows? I mean, this is a model, is an incredibly dangerous model. The sole purpose of this model is essentially to take away rights in a way that keeps them from being challenged in advance. You can always be challenged in an individual case, right? Even in Texas, if somebody decides to sue someone who's getting an abortion or aiding and abetting abortion and goes into court, the defense in that particular case will be, this is wildly unconstitutional. The problem with these bounty cases, these kinds of statutes, the problem with them is that you can't, so the court believed, challenge them in advance. And so if you can't challenge them in advance and they stay on the books and they essentially silence, eliminate abortion providers. Now, let me say, in my view, in my judgment, they could have been challenged in advance. In my judgment, the district court in Texas decided, that there was no bar, no immunity, it was called, to suing these individuals in advance before the law was enforced. In my view, the Court of Appeals that reversed him was simply wrong. And in any event, the Supreme Court, in that one paragraph decision at midnight last week, was totally wrong. And wrong in this respect, whether or not you enjoin the operation of law is a balancing test. What are the legal issues on the one hand and the harm on the other? Harm here was incredible to the women who are seeking abortions. Harm to the Constitution, since this was not even close to constitutional. And the legal issues, while they were more complicated because the way the law was written, don't outweigh the harm to women and the harm to the Constitution, of essentially a legislature saying, I don't care about Roe v. Wade, I'm going to do what I want.
All right. On that note, Judge Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, WBUR's legal analyst, thank you so much.
Okay.